Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Tonight, I want to welcome Sean Kevin Jason. He is an experiencer and self-proclaimed precognitive whose abilities led him to a close encounter with a triangle UFO near Area 51. His work on precognitive abilities and theories about a control system closely follows on the heels of Dr. Jacques Vallée and Dr. Carl Jung. Aside from two books which feature his story, he has been interviewed by the TV programs Mysteries Decoded on CW and the Travel Channel special Storming Area 51. His story will also be featured in an upcoming series On the Trail of UFOs by Small Town Monsters this coming spring. Sean, welcome. How are you doing tonight?
Not too bad. Thank you for having me, Chris. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for joining us. I find your story so fascinating. I haven't heard anything quite like it, and it brings a whole new twist, not only to the psychic or precognitive phenomenon, but also UFOs, contact experiences, and the paranormal. And lately, I've been led on a series of synchronistic events that leads me to interviewing more and more people like yourself that validate that this phenomenon is linked to our consciousness, and it's all linked together in some strange way, and it keeps getting deeper and deeper. But let's start at the beginning of your story. Where did this all start for you in terms of what you thought were, you know, precognitive abilities?
Well, it began when I was a teenager, actually. I came from a troubled home, so I kind of was raised on the streets of Las Vegas running around with the wrong kids. And I got in trouble a lot, so naturally, you know, my instinct was to, you know, try to stay out of trouble, keep away from the cops, more or less avoiding getting arrested and thrown in juvie, and, of course, having to answer to my parents, especially my father. So one particular day, I was on a street corner with my friend and I, and just mid-sentence, I interrupted him because I just had this strong, overwhelming kind of infused knowledge, if you want to call it, that there was a cop car approaching from behind us, or at least from behind me. He was facing the direction the cop car was coming from. Of course, I was right. You know, I asked him, hey, is there a cop car coming from behind? His mouth kind of dropped open, and he was just dumbfounded. And I turned around, and of course, I see this cop car approaching us. And he was asking me, well, how did you know this cop car was coming? And you know, I didn't have an answer at that time. I had no idea. Just, I knew. And from there on out, it was kind of wondering if I could repeat that, do it again. Since I had done it once, I figured, you know, I was right on the first time, so there's no reason I thought that I couldn't do it again. And it happened again, and it just progressively kept happening until my friends actually nicknamed me Radar, because I kind of had the sixth sense for detecting cop cars, you know, especially when you're out getting into trouble. It was kind of a cool thing you probably want to have.
Was it just happening with cop cars?
Yeah, it was just a cop car thing. So I thought this was just some weird ability I had for just filling out cop cars, kind of like a Spider-Man in this Spidey sense, kind of when he can sense danger. So I just figured this was a weird knack I had for detecting cop cars, and didn't really think it was anything like precognition or anything like that. I just could tell ahead of time when and where a cop car would be. So we kind of used that to our advantage. And progressively, it got stronger and stronger. So when it would happen, it was kind of like the second time and there on out. It was more like a static air feeling, kind of static electricity in the air where your hair stands up, kind of get goosebumps on your skin and everything. At the same time, I would be able to, you know, pick out what direction these cop cars were coming from. And then from there, progressively turned into started hearing voices that would give me instructions or give me information.
Okay, could you give us some examples of, like, what happened with the voices, you know, I guess with some of your earlier experiences?
The first time it happened, I was a sophomore in high school, and I was ditching school that day. Kind of just had taken the school bus to school. As soon as I got off the bus, just walked off the campus and figured I was going to, you know, take the day off. Didn't really have anywhere to go. Just didn't want to go to school. So I had found a business I was going to just kind of hang out behind and ditch for most of the morning until one of the arcades opened up there by school. And I'm just kind of hanging out behind this building, having a cigarette, kind of just trying to keep low key out of people's sight so no one would report me. And while I'm there, I hear a voice just really loud tell me, run. I just hear run with, like, you know, a bunch of exclamations after it. And I was stunned because I've never had this experience before. It was the first time. So I'm trying to figure out, you know, what is this voice? Where did this voice come from? Am I actually hearing it through my ears or something in my head? You know, why is it telling me to run? But my instinct was to just do what it told me and to run. It didn't tell me what direction to go, how fast to run, just run. So I just started running as fast as I could from out behind this business and kind of run out towards the front of it, towards the street that was right next to it. And as I'm approaching the street, I see five truant cars closing in on my position. You know, three were coming from my right, two were coming from my left. So I decided to just run straight through the street, through the cars, and all of them are basically converging right on me in the middle of the street as I'm kind of plowing through these cars and heading straight for someone's backyard, this tall cinder block wall that was right in front of me. And I kind of just leaped up over this wall and, you know, I was gone. And I went through a couple people's yards and a few streets over until I found someone's yard I can kind of hide out in for the rest of the morning. And I kind of just ducked and covered behind this bush and spent all morning there until it was lunch break. But while I was there, you know, I was just trying to figure out what exactly just happened because, you know, this was my first experience with the voice and, you know, it's kind of warning of something happening before it actually does.
So take us through some of the events that happened afterwards. Were there, you know, any other events that led to you kind of questioning this a little bit more, you know, at an early age?
So, yeah, after that happened, it happened one more time where I was it happened many more times, but the second time it happened was again with truant officers. I was ditching school in the same area, and I was actually at the arcade I just mentioned previously. So this was sometime after. I was ditching at the arcade, and it seemed a lot of people were ditching that day, so the place was packed. And I was just playing a video game when I heard the voice again tell me to keep playing. And again, I was just dumbfounded. I'm like, you know, I'm playing the game. What do you mean keep playing? And what exactly, you know, is this voice talking about? Why I keep playing? But maybe a few seconds right after I hear the voice, all of a sudden I hear all this commotion going on in the arcade. Excuse me, from the front of it. And I see a bunch of kids running around, you know, all crazy, like something just happened. And it turned out truant officers had surrounded the building and were coming in through the front door. The game I was playing on was just next to the back door. So right after I realized they're coming in the front door, I see them start pouring in through the back door to round up all the kids. And at that point, it dawned on me that's what the voice had meant to keep playing. So I just stood there and kept playing the arcade game. Like I wasn't totally, you know, like I wasn't affected at all by the truant officers being there, and it didn't bother me one bit. So I just kept playing the arcade game, and they're rounding up all the other kids, hauling them outside, and I just stood there playing the game the whole time until I was the only person left in the building. One of the truant officers came over to me, and he's kind of just, you know, to the side of the arcade game, staring at me, like, you know, trying to figure me out. And I'm not minding him any business. I'm just totally into the game, just ignoring him. And while I'm playing, he asked me, how old are you? And I tell him, you know, I'm old enough that you don't see me running around with my head chopped off like these kids. And he kind of gives me a grin, and he just walks out of the building and leaves. And, you know, they clear out. And pretty soon it's just myself there and the owner. And, you know, finally I stopped playing. Like, are they gone? The owner's like, yeah, you're safe. And he's asked me, how in the, you know, are you still standing here? And the only thing I could say was, you know, I kept playing. I didn't say anything about the voice, but, you know, I just kept playing like it told me, and I didn't get hauled off. So again, you know, at that point I was still thinking this is some kind of cop detection ability, truant detection ability, something to that effect. And not long thereafter, I kind of cleaned up my act, stopped hanging out with the wrong crowd, started going to school, doing good, all that sort of thing. And I figured at that point, whatever this thing was would stop. Because I figured, you know, if I'm not out on the streets getting in trouble anymore, ditch the school, all that sort of thing, then whatever it was would be over with. And the third time it happened, I was playing, I had joined up with the softball league. And one night, you know, we had a game, and I was next up to bat, and I'm sitting in a dugout when the voice tells me I'm going to take out the pitcher. And I thought, well, here's, you know, I was confused because this was the first time I heard the voice tell me something about the future that had nothing to do with cops or truant or anything like that. So I was a little skeptical as to whether or not it was actually going to happen, but also dumbfounded about, you know, here's telling me I'm going to take out the pitcher, which for me meant, you know, basically a line drive to the chest. So I start telling all my teammates, hey, watch this. I'm going to take the pitcher out. And, you know, I get up to bat. My team is up in the dugout. They're all, you know, lined up against the fence, basically chanting, you know, take, there's a co-ed league. So, you know, guy, girl, and she, you know, is a female pitcher, and they're all screaming, you know, take her out, take her out, take her out. And I'm up at bat. She pitches, and I strike out on the first one. And I'm thinking, you know, great. You know, I just told my whole team what's going to happen. But at the same time, I'm thinking, you know, here was an opportunity for me to show other people that I can, you know, predict the future by telling them this is what's going to happen next. Especially for something like that, you know, I could barely hit the ball in any direction I want to, much less specifically take the pitcher out with a line drive. But she pitches the second ball, and it's kind of like everything turned slow motion at that point as I'm watching the ball come towards me. And I just put everything I have into the swing, and I just nail the ball. And I'm watching it fly directly towards her. And I can see her bringing both of her arms up because it's going straight for her chest. But it had so much speed behind it. You know, she barely gets her arms up before the ball just plows into her chest. And it was almost like you see in the movies where someone gets shot point blank with a shotgun, you know, and they go flying back kind of like a Matrix effect. I just watch her fly back off the mound and hit the ground. And at this point, my first reaction is, of course, just run. You know, you hit the ball, you run for first base. I wasn't really even thinking about the fact that I just, you know, did exactly what I said I was going to and take her out. So I got halfway to first base when I stopped because I looked to my right, and I'm right in front of the dugout, and all my teammates are standing there, and it's completely silent. They're all hanging there with their jaws wide open, and they're just dumbfounded. And I look to the left, and she's still lying on the ground and not moving. And at this point, I'm a little concerned that maybe I killed her, you know, because she's not moving at all. There's just no sign of any life from her, and I'm standing there like, do I go and help her? If I go help her, is another teammate going to grab the ball and try to tag me out? Do I go to first base? Like, what do I do? And, you know, I'm maybe getting concerned that I might be going to prison or jail because I just told everyone, watch what I'm going to do to this pitcher, and there she is lying on the ground. And if she's dead, you know, how am I going to explain that one? And everyone is just, it was just completely silent. Everyone is kind of just waiting for her to start moving, getting up. And enough time passed that finally the coach ran out, her parents ran out on the field, you know, to check on her. And it turns out she was okay, but had just knocked the wind out of her and knocked her out. And so I went on to first base, and that was kind of it. We played that team a few times after that game, and she remained a pitcher, you know, much to her credit, but she would never pitch me another ball again. You know, every time I was up to the plate, I got a free walk. And that's when I knew that whatever I was dealing with wasn't, you know, just some cop ability or some radar ability, but I was dealing with something else here.
Wow. Did that continue throughout your, you know, teenage years and into adulthood?
It did. But after that incident, you know, I felt a bit of remorse. for what I did to that girl, and a bit of concern because, you know, I really had no control over what this thing was or how it worked. So when I did that to that girl, you know, I was afraid that, you know, somehow I may kill someone accidentally with this, whatever it was. And, you know, I was scared of it at that point. I just wanted it to stop and go away, whatever it was. And it did for many years. It was a good number of years after that incident before it would happen again. And the next time it happened is when I went out to Area 51.
Okay, well, yeah. So take us through that. What led to you going out there?
Well, I was at work. And once again, now I should mention, too, that in addition to hearing the voice, there's also a physical sensation that accompanies it. So it's kind of like a gut, a feeling in your gut. It's kind of like a cross between butterflies, you know, getting butterflies in your stomach when you're nervous, or kind of like that roller coaster when you suddenly drop and you feel like your stomach is just lifting up into your throat. It's like a combination of those feelings together at the same time you're hearing the voice. So I was at work and heard a voice again, and it was telling me to go to Area 51, which at that time, you know, I was heavy into the whole UFO alien thing, Area 51. This was March of 1996. So, of course, you know, X-Files was on, and UFOs was constantly out there in the pop culture at that time. So it told me to go to Area 51, and there was only one reason I'd ever gone out to Area 51 was, you know, in hopes of seeing a UFO or having a close encounter. The problem was when, you know, it was telling me to go to Area 51, I was kind of torn between, is this the voice or is this some kind of communication from the occupants of the UFO that are reaching out to me? Because often in these, many of these contact cases, you know, they have some, you know, instinct or some kind of communication with telling them to go out to this remote location and meet up with the UFO and its occupants. So I was kind of torn which way, was this the voice I'm used to hearing or is this something else? Right thereafter, my boss had asked me if I want to leave work early because it was a slow day. You know, she wanted to cut back on staff. So, of course, you know, I said yes and got out of there as quick as I could. And I had swung by my mother's house. I wanted to see about borrowing a camera from my brother. But unfortunately, you know, it wasn't available at the time. So I left from there, went home, got changed, let the wife know where I was going, and then headed on out to Area 51. I wasn't on the road for maybe 15 minutes, not that far out of town. The apex exit on Highway 93, and it's kind of headed north when it starts bending to the right, kind of in a northeast direction. And up ahead, I see some lights, and they were at ground level, so I figured this was just a, you know, another car that was approaching me way off in the distance because it's just a long straight shot away, and you can see pretty far. So I didn't think anything of it at first, just figured it was another car. And as I'm getting closer, you know, I realized these lights weren't moving. So I thought maybe this car was broken down off on the side of the highway. And I'm wondering whether or not I should help these people and stop, see if they need assistance, or if I should just keep on trucking past them. I didn't know whether I was on some kind of time limit, you know, how fast I needed to be out the Area 51 for whatever this voice was trying to get me out there for. And the whole time I'm driving to, you know, everything is just going through my head. What kind of occupants am I going to meet? You know, aliens, are they going to be friendly? Is this going to be a classic abduction case or more of a contact, kind of roll out the red carpet and give you a tour of the universe kind of deal? So I really didn't know what to expect, but you know, everything's just running through my head. And as I'm getting closer to the lights, I realize that they're not on the road, but they're actually hovering over the road. And I was kind of knee-jerk reaction, slammed on my brakes, because my first reaction was, this is, you know, a Metro Police helicopter, some kind of speed trap or something out there. So I figured I better slow down because I was already speeding at that point, just trying to get out there fast enough. And I grabbed my binoculars, you know, thinking that this is probably whatever the, you know, voice was getting me out there for, because that whole helicopter speed trap idea didn't last for long, just because, you know, this was a remote location. It just didn't make any sense for them to be out there. And so I'm looking through my binoculars, trying to drive at the same time. I can tell that something's hovering over the road, but I couldn't exactly see, you know, what it was. And plus, I was having issues trying to drive and look through binoculars at the same time, and nearly lost control of my car. So, I kind of just tossed them in the back seat and decided to just step on it and see if I can get there, you know, fast enough before it left. So I pull up underneath the craft, and right away I can tell it's an equilateral black triangle. And it had nine lights on the bottom of it. And actually, I got my model right here if you want to see.
Yeah, sure.
So you can kind of get an idea here. This is what the craft looked like. Let's see here.
Oh, cool.
So if you can imagine, I was parked right underneath the front light here. So this was directly above me. And it was about 20 feet off the road. So I'm just parked there, and I'm just dumbfounded, just in, you know, shock and awe kind of feeling, looking up at this craft. And I'm even more confused because the lights I'm looking at were standard filament bulbs. You know, there was nothing unusual, exotic, alien about these lights on it. They were standard filaments, incandescent bulbs. They were fairly large, but they were just, you know, your standard floodlights. And they all were exactly the same.
So this may have been a military craft.
At the time, I'm thinking, you know, this looks man-made, but at the same time, I'm dealing with the whole voice thing, you know, was this an alien communication? Was this this precognitive thing? You know, what exactly is going on? But, you know, my reaction was, yeah, this looks man-made. It looks stealth. The skin of the craft, I couldn't make anything out on that just because it was pitch black. In fact, the underside of the craft was darker than the night sky. So kind of, you know, silhouette against the sky. And I decided I wanted to get a really close-up look at the light bulbs. And, of course, I had thrown my binoculars in the back seat. So I'm trying to reach behind me and grab them without taking my eyes off the craft. And I couldn't find them. So I knew I was going to have to turn around and actually look for them. And I did turn around and look for them, but in that short time, it had taken off. So binoculars in hand, I turn around, it's gone, and I'm scanning the horizon looking for it, and I can see it more to my 7 o'clock position now. I had moved a good ways away from the car, but I can now see the top of the craft. And it was moving away probably about the speed of a helicopter. And it moved away to the 7 o'clock position before it kind of made a right-hand turn, which would have been moving north towards the Nellis Air Force Range. And up to that point, when you're talking about propulsion and the way UFOs fly, I always expect kind of up, down, left, right, you know, that sort of deal. But this thing hugged the ground like it was falling along the contours of the ground. So, you know, the contour of the ground changes, it changed with it. So it was almost like it was tracing the contour of the ground in the sky, even when it crawled over the mountains to the north of our position. So rather than, you know, shoot straight up and then fly over the mountains like that, it kind of crawled up the mountain like this, as if it 4x4'd up the side of it, and then just disappeared over the top of it and down the other side.
Now, there was no other visible features on the craft. It's just completely black.
Yeah, it was just completely black. And that's how I knew the, when it flew away from me, that's where I could make out the top of the craft through my binoculars and was able to see that portion of it.
How fast was the craft traveling?
about, you know, average helicopter speed when a helicopter is really, you know, booking, not much faster than that. And it was completely silent. And during the incident, my car ran the whole time. I was revving the gas just to make sure it's running. No power failures, anything like that. No sound, completely silent. The whole thing maybe lasted about 10 minutes long from the first time I saw the lights until I watched it crawl over the side of that mountain onto the other side of it.
Did anything happen after that?
Well, at that point, I'm thinking, okay, this is maybe the prelude. You know, this is just the intro. There's still more to come because it told me to go to Area 51. So I'm thinking, you know, maybe once I get to Area 51, there's still more to come. So I, you know, I continued on my drive out there, which was still a good ways away because I wasn't that far out of Las Vegas when this happened. So I kept driving, got all the way out there to Area 51, and but it was uneventful for the rest of the drive, including when I got there and hung out there for a while. Never saw anything else. So on the drive back, it was also uneventful, but it had occurred to me then that, you know, the voice telling me to go to Area 51 didn't necessarily mean go to Area 51. It was just the fact that I would be in the right place at the right time when this craft was going to be over the road, which was on the way to Area 51.
Now looking back, do you think that it was some sort of military craft?
Yeah, absolutely. Some type of advanced stealth aircraft. Certainly the light bulbs on it were, you know, a dead giveaway. A lot of people, they're not too crazy about the whole man-made theory or explanation. It's either all aliens or nothing at all kind of deal. But certainly those light bulbs, I put it this way, you know, if aliens are so advanced that they can build craft that would travel the vast distance required to get here, you would think they can make a better light bulb than we do. Because that light bulb on that craft was no different than anything we would use today. In fact, we've already moved on to LEDs for a lot of things. So a filament bulb is kind of antique, ancient, antiquated technology.
Wow. Now, so at this point, did you start to do any type of research into what was going on with you?
I did, because at that point, the whole voice thing really troubled me, because, you know, I thought I was done with it. After that whole incident with the softball game, I thought that was it. And here, you know, it popped up again. And I knew there was something more to it. Obviously, this wasn't some radar ability that only detected cops. There was something else going on here. And as well with the whole triangle I encountered, you know, up to that, I was one of those, it's all alien or nothing guys. You know, I didn't believe that it was even possible we could have that type of technology, and there were no man-made UFOs. So I had to go back and start over from scratch and take another look at the whole UFO phenomenon to see whether it is possible that we've been building these, some or all. So, yeah, absolutely. You know, after that, I started digging into it further from both of those angles, trying to figure out, you know, what was happening to me with this kind of psychic ability, I thought, at that time. And there were more incidents later with the voice that gave me a lot more insight into what was going on and how it actually works.
Well, let's definitely talk about that. I understand there were some incidents with your daughter. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, so it happened three more times with my, all three were involved with my daughter. And it stemmed from an accident that happened with her when she almost died in my arms. We had a babysitter next door that, you know, we had trusted with her and used her frequently to watch our kids. And my daughter was still at the crawling age at that point. And she had came over and asked if she could play with my daughter and bring her back next door, which I didn't see a problem with. You know, we had trusted her, like I said, and so I was home alone, and I think I was in the kitchen at the time when I hear her burst in the house, yelling and screaming my name. And I knew immediately that something was wrong, just by the tone of her voice, that something wasn't right. So I come running out to the living room, and I see her holding my daughter, and my daughter is as blue as a Smurf, you know, or it just, her skin everywhere is just completely blue. And I was kind of just instantly shocked because I've never seen anyone's skin turn blue before. And I can see she's still alive because she's looking around with her eyes, but she's not making any sound whatsoever. You know, I realize she's choking to death on something. And I've done CPR training before. And with infants, you know, it's a little different just because of their size and how fragile infants are versus, say, you know, doing a Heimlich on an adult. And I'm trying my best to dislodge whatever was in her throat, but I couldn't get it out, you know, to save my life or hers. And at the last minute, I just got some crazy idea to hang her upside down and start jumping up and down at the same time I was kind of, you know, doing a Heimlich on her. And after a few times of doing this, you know, I hear this tink. I didn't think anything of it, but then I hear this like vacuum sound. And shortly after the vacuum, she just lets out this blood-curdling scream. And, you know, at that point, I realized I had dislodged whatever she was choking on. Turned out she had swallowed a dime and got stuck in her throat. But the fear of that incident of having her almost die in my arms kind of traumatized me and made me, like, overly protective of my daughter to where, you know, you go from one extreme to the other. And so not too long after that, she started walking, and we had a staircase. You know, this was a two-story town hall. And we used the child safety gates top and the bottom. But I knew sooner or later she was going to have to learn how to walk up and down the staircase. And when I was home with her, every time she would either walk up and down, I always made it a point to follow her or lead in front of her, depending on which direction she was going. That way, if she ever fell, I was there to catch her. You know, and without fail, no matter what I was doing, I would stop to assist her. And, you know, a lot of this stemmed out of my fear of that choking incident to where she almost died. And in my head, I would go over this kind of mental exercise, this kind of training exercise where I would envision her falling down the staircase and my, you know, catching her and saving her before she hits the bottom. Because at the bottom of the staircase was this really large kind of rock fireplace I was afraid she would run into if she actually did go downstairs. So this went on for months on end. Up and down the stairs, up and down the stairs, why I would do this mental exercise, the same one over and over. And in all that time, she never fell, not once, never even lost her footing or lost her balance. Now, she did great, so I figured there was no need for me to escort her anymore. She mastered the stairs, and she didn't need me at that point. So one day, I'm sitting at my computer down in the dining room, and I heard the voice again tell me my daughter's going to fall downstairs. And I'm like, okay. I didn't get it at first because my daughter was nowhere near the stairs. But within a few seconds, my daughter comes past me, goes to the stairs, and starts walking up the stairs. I'm like, okay. So I figured, you know, nothing's going to happen because I can just walk right over and I'm going to be right behind her. She's not going to fall. So I did. I walk over to the stairs, get right behind her, and I start walking up the staircase with her and get only a few steps up. And I realize, you know, this is ridiculous. There's no way she's going to fall down the stairs. I started doubting the voice, figuring it's got to be wrong. There's no way it could be right because she hasn't mastered. So I watch her as she walks up the staircase and then disappears behind a curve. You know, there's like a three more steps at the top once you get around the bend in the staircase. And I heard her walk and get all the way to the top. And I'm like, okay, that's never happened before because anytime I've heard this voice, it's always been 100% correct. So how is it she didn't fall downstairs? So I'm kind of just in a daze, staring off into space, kind of lost in my thoughts, trying to figure out what just occurred when I suddenly hear my wife yelling and screaming at me. And I couldn't make out what she's saying. I turned to my right to look at her, and I just see she's pointing up the staircase and just blabbing at me. And I look up, and I see my daughter rolling down the staircase towards me, just in enough time to drop my arms down as she rolls into my arms, and I pick her up. And, you know, she was fine, nothing, you know, no injuries or anything like that. But at that point, I was, you know, really confused because, you know, I watched her make it to the top. So how is it she even fell down the stairs at all? And, you know, what was going on here? And that was the first accident with her. And
did you find out how she actually fell?
I have some ideas, yeah. So I suspect that when I stopped following her and she got to the top of the stairs and realized I wasn't behind her anymore, that she probably turned around, came back down the staircase to see what I was doing, to check on me, and in so doing, tripped and fell. So here's the funny thing, and I'll get into it with the other two examples. The second time this happened was probably just a week later after the first incident. So all three incidents with her happened within a two-week time frame. The second accident, we went to visit some friends of the wife out in the countryside. And they had a really long driveway. The house was kind of just remote on a lot of land. And I had stepped outside for a cigarette break, and I was out there by myself when I heard the voice again tell me my daughter's going to get her hand slammed in the car door. And again, I'm doubting this because I'm like, my daughter's nowhere around. The car's all the way down the driveway. You know, I'm not exactly sure at this point how it's all going to play out. So I continue smoking my cigarette when my son comes outside and wants to grab a toy from the car. So, you know, I give him permission. Yeah, you know, go get your toy. Walks down the driveway, opens up the passenger side, gets into the car, grabs his toy, and he's kind of just sitting there fiddling with it. Car door's open, and he's just standing there fiddling with his toy. And soon thereafter, my daughter comes out. And I'm like, okay, now this is starting to come together, because my daughter gets curious as to what my son is doing, wants to go out and see what he's doing and you know, join him. So I'm thinking, okay, so this is probably what the voice is warning me about. You know, she's supposed to go out there, get her hand slammed in the door, but I got time to stop it, right? Because I already know what's going to happen. So I figured, you know, I'll just yell at my son to close the door, problem solved. So I start yelling at my son, you know, close the door, close the door. I know he can hear me, but he just seems to be ignoring me. And, you know, I keep repeatedly telling him, you know, Gabe, close the car door. And, you know, I'm getting nothing from him. I'm like, okay. I start screaming at him now, close, you know, close the damn car door. And she's walking out there while this is all going on. And I'm thinking, you know, at first I had plenty of time to, you know, stop this before it happened. But now it's getting closer and closer. She's getting closer to the car. And I can start seeing it all fall together. So, you know, I'm just kind of just lost, because even though I know what's about to happen, I can't seem to do anything to prevent it from happening. Even though I'm trying to do everything I can, it all seems to be actually contributing to it. So I yell at him a few more times, and finally, you know, I give up, because she's at the car now, and she's, you know, the front of the car is facing me. She's coming around the driver's side, coming around the back, and then coming up behind me. So I just run. You know, I just book down the driveway, figured I could beat her to the car and get that car door shut before she gets to it. But for one, I left too late, didn't get there fast enough. And when my son saw me running towards him full speed, he got this look on his face like, you know, oh, crap, I'm about to get my ass beat, kind of look on his face. And he knew he was in trouble, because he knew he was, you know, blowing me off and ignoring me the whole time. So without thinking, he grabs the car door and goes to slam it shut just when my daughter crept up behind him and was reaching into the car. So, you know, lo and behold, the door slams right on her hand. Perfect timing. And, you know, she lets out this blood-curdling scream. Of course, I was on top of the car, you know, maybe a second or two right after she had it slammed on her hand. And I opened up the car door, and, you know, she had no injuries on her hand, which I was amazed, because her hand was buried in that door, and it was completely shut. But she was completely fine, other than, you know, being scared to death of having the door closed on it. So then, you know, after that, I was, you know, I was kind of freaking out because here I was starting to realize that this voice wasn't warning me what's about to happen. It was actually producing the event that's about to happen. So on one hand, yeah, it is telling you, hey, your daughter's going to get her hand slammed in the car door, which that much was true. You know, that was a future event that did happen. But at the same time, I had no idea that all the choices I was going to make would lead up to that incident actually happening.
And now, before you get into that a little more, tell us about the third incident.
Okay, so the third time now, I was in the kitchen doing the dishes, and my boys were in the backyard playing on the swing set. And this one was different because I was used to hearing the voice, you know, tell me, either provide some type of information or it would give me a command. But this time I saw a vision, which I had never seen before. It's as if, you know, a projector just kind of started playing a picture in front of your eyes. And I can see my daughter getting kicked in the face by one of my boys on the swing set. And she was actually running outside just when I saw this vision. And so she runs out the back door. I see this vision, and immediately I start yelling her name. And soon thereafter, I hear her screaming. So I run out the back door, go to check on her. And, of course, she had walked right into my son swinging, who kind of just, you know, kicked her right in the face, knocked her on the ground. And apparently when I screamed her name, it had drew her attention away from the swing set back towards the house. At the same moment, she walked right into my son. And, of course, the vision played into all of that and actually caused it begin to happen.
All these events happen, and you're piecing together, you know, that it's not, you know, telling you future events, but it's possibly causing them. Explain a little bit more about that.
So, like, of course, with the car door example, you know, here is telling me my daughter's going to have her hand slammed in the car door. So this is obviously a future event that's going to happen. And my thinking is, well, you know, I know what's about to happen. So any choice I make, you know, I have time to stop it. You know, there's time to change that future event to prevent it from happening. But it would turn out that all the choices I made were actually the cause of the accident, rather than preventing it from happening. And so everything I was doing that I thought would stop it was actually leading up to the event itself. But, you know, it was precognition in respect that this is information about the future, but having that information itself caused the event.
Do you think it was your higher self or your future self that was giving you these messages?
And that's what, you know, we tend to go down that road. You know, I've heard people say, well, maybe this is a guardian angel communicating with you, or, you know, a higher self kind of thing. Something along those lines, the universe is communicating with you. And actually, it turns out to be a lot stranger than that. From my research and what I've been working on, trying to understand this voice and how this all works and what it means, actually comes back to causality. So we know cause and effect, causality, the standard causality that we all grew up with. But it turns out causality actually works in reverse as well. And one example of that would be synchronicity, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and a lot of people in this kind of arena are familiar with synchronicity, brought forth by Carl Jung. So synchronicity is kind of what he termed in a meaningful relationship between events that's anti-causal, or there doesn't seem to be a cause and effect relationship between these events, yet there seems to be a deeper meaningful connection. So an example, I don't know what your favorite band or singer is. Let's say you're driving down a highway and you're Britney Spears' biggest fan, you know, and you just adore Britney Spears, love her to death. And you're driving down this highway and you think, something comes to mind and you're thinking, man, that would be so great if she would play at this arena, you know, down the street from my house on my birthday. You know, that would be just awesome. And a mile down the road, you come across this billboard for this concert that is actually playing at that arena, and it just happens to be on your birthday. That would be synchronicity. Now, typically, we think in that situation, well, it's, you know, usually it's a coincidence, you know, or a chance, or, you know, get kind of new agey. It's the universe communicating with you, you know, you're supposed to be there or something to that effect. But what we're actually dealing with is a future event that is influencing the past, and you're responding to the event before it happens. So typically when something happens, we're responding to something after it happens, but it turns out we can also react to things before they happen. And that would be an example of synchronicity. Another would be like, you're at home watching TV and suddenly an old high school friend comes to mind that you haven't talked to in ages, you know, and you're wondering how they're doing and what they've been up to. And the next thing you know, your phone rings and it turns out, lo and behold, they're on the phone calling and checking in on you. So again, we would say, well, it's a coincidence or it's a chance, you know, it's the universe communicating with me, but it's actually just retrocausality or reacting, responding to future events before we've actually experienced them. And we're just unaware of the fact that we're responding to these events.
Do you think that everyone has the ability to sense this and that it's possibly just stronger with you? You've tapped into it a little bit more?
Definitely is something everyone is able to do. In fact, if it was not for this, I don't think reality could exist in the way we experience it, because it seems to be a necessary function of reality. The same way your body is able to control your temperature, you know, this is actually the result of a control system. So the voices I determine are what we would call an air signal in a control system. And the air signal is responsible for riding a difference that was detected between the desired state and the current state. So with people, you have causality, which is a prograde kind of, you know, cause and effect. But then you have retrocausality. So synchronicity is where a future event is influencing the past and we're responding to it. But it's not changing the past in a way that is producing the future event. So like the Britney Spears example with the highway sign, you know, you're responding to this future event, you're picking up on it, and you're saying how great it would be if she played on your birthday at that venue, but that reaction to the sign isn't responsible for putting the sign there. Whereas a precog would possibly pick up on that and say, up ahead is going to be a sign saying Britney Spears is going to play at this venue on such and such dates. But in the examples I've given with, say, my daughter or the UFO, the actual perception of the event caused the event to happen. So this is where retrocausality influences the past, and that influence changes the past in such a way that it produces the future event.
Very, very interesting. And you know, thinking about it, I can, you know, think of some experiences myself where it seems like I would have, you know, experienced this myself looking back. And do you think that, you know, certain psychic phenomenon is different than retrocausality?
Well, I think it has a lot of different names. So, you know, you have retrocausality, you have precognition, you have gut instinct, you have intuition, but a lot of it is really all the same thing, just different names. I think a lot of psychic phenomenon exist for the purpose of a control system. And this control system exists to serve retrocausality. So take an air conditioner, for example. With an air conditioner, you can set the thermostat to a certain temperature. Say you want your house to be set 72 degrees. Now, the control system is responsible for automating this process. If it's going to keep it at 72 degrees, it needs to be able to detect, obviously, when the temperature goes up or down, and then turn on when there's a difference between the temperature you want it at and the temperature is actually turned into. And that's where the control system comes into play. So let's say the temperature raises up to 75 degrees. It's going to detect that difference between what you want it at 72 and its current state of 75. the control system spits out an air signal and says, basically, turn on. So the AC is turning on due to this air signal, which is basically producing a causal pathway between the current state of 75 degrees and the future desired state of 72 degrees. So when the voice would tell me, you know, do such and such, or this is going to happen, essentially it's a new predetermined future event that is now creating a causal pathway to that new future pathway. So it's kind of like, I mean, it gets a little out there because this is, you know, this is all new territory. This is stuff, you know, Dr. Jacques Vallée has been working on, and is pretty far out there. But now we're kind of getting into the whole multiverse theory and things of that nature, and a self-consistent reality to where there are no paradoxes except for this one single paradox, which is also called a bootstrap paradox. It's essentially, like in this case with, you know, my daughter falling down the stairs. You know, the voice tells me she's going to fall down the stairs, so I go to prevent it from happening, but my actions actually cause the accident to happen. So we have this time loop here to where is both the cause and the effect. So this incident itself kind of just comes out of nowhere because it shouldn't exist. Because there is no causal pathway, essentially, to it happening. It just kind of manifests, and suddenly you're on this different pathway as a result of it.
Now, you said, you know, for an example, with the experiences with your daughter, that it seemed like no matter what you did, this event was going to happen. Do you think that it's possible that we can alter some of these events, or yourself? Have you ever been able to alter any of these events?
Well, I mean, another term you can call it is a self-fulfilling prophecy. So once you have this information, it's done. I mean, no matter what you try to do to prevent it from happening, those choices are actually going to cause it to happen. And one thing I did learn is the way the voice communicates. So like the example, go to Area 51, you know, that's a command, or run, that's a command. Keep playing was a command. But in the case of my daughter, it came across as information like, your daughter's going to fall down the stairs, or your daughter's going to get her hand slammed in the car door. So I began to realize there was a pattern between the way the voice communicated and how the incident played out. So in the case of Area 51, go to Area 51 as a command, this was something I wanted. You know, I wanted to have that contact with the UFO. It was something I desired and willed. So it wasn't something I objected to. I was totally willing to go through with it. Or in the case of the cops, you know, run. It was because I didn't want to get busted or arrested or taken to juvie. So obviously I was going to do whatever it would take to escape and get away from them. But with my daughter, when it came across as information, it did so because this was something I did not want to happen and I wanted to prevent from happening. So there was a pattern between the command. It would come across as a command when it was something I wanted, but it would come across as information when it was something I didn't want but would try to prevent from happening. And in the same time, that last incident with my daughter, you know, it came across as a vision, and why not a voice? That last incident with the daughter was the only time I didn't actually see the event unfold with my own eyes. Every other time it would happen, I actually saw the event unfold. Whereas that time, I didn't get to see it unfold. So it would seem that when I wasn't there to see it unfold, you know, the message came across as a vision rather than the voice.
Now, have you ever had any other, I guess you could say, contact experiences or paranormal or UFO?
Yeah, I've actually seen 3 UFOs, but I usually don't talk about the other two just because this one, you know, was up close and personal, and the other two were, you know, they're interesting, but, you know, I couldn't really make a definitive kind of theory one way or the other on them. I did hear the voice one more time. There was an 8th time that it happened. It was rather bizarre compared to the other examples. So the 8th time it happened, my oldest son was really big on dinosaurs when he was a kid. You know, Crocodile Hunter, reptiles, dinosaurs was big back then. And this was when Disney had just released that dinosaur movie. And so I decided I was going to take my boys to go see it. And it was a Sunday morning at 10:45. The movie was playing at 11:15 that morning. Fair go catch a matinee with them. And we were leaving the house at 10:45. We all load up in the car. And just when I'm getting into the car, I hear the voice. And it's telling me, and the voice was, all the other times I heard the voice, it was never scary. It never intimidated. You know, it wasn't necessarily friendly, but it wasn't also an enemy kind of feeling from it. Whereas this time when they told me, do not look at the clock, it almost sounded like the wrath of Satan yelling in my head, do not look at the clock. And it petrified and scared the hell out of me. And, you know, it was the first time I heard the voice come across like that. On top of that, usually I had that gut physical sensation that would accompany the voice. This time, you know, I did not get that feeling. It was just strictly this demonic sounding voice telling me, do not look at the clock. So I'm petrified now. I'm trying not to react to it because I don't want to scare my boys. But yet, you know, I'm scared to death myself. And, it, you know, there was a clock built into the dash of the car. So I continued on. We left the house. I'm driving to the movie theater. At the whole time, I'm keeping my eyes strictly on the road, trying not to look at the clock. And even though I want to, I just could not bring myself to look at the clock to see what time it was. So we drive to the theater. I had missed a turn, had to make a U-turn, come back around, but it didn't take too much time to do that. Get to the theater. I'm just happy to get out of the car and arrive, and, you know, nothing happened. And, you know, I figured, you know, we get there safely, no problem. And I go up to the movie box to purchase our tickets for the movie, and, you know, I tell her, you know, three tickets for the 11:15 showing a dinosaur. And she just looks at me with just dumbfounded, stupid look, like I'm a moron. And I'm kind of like, why are you looking at me like that? She's like, the 11:15 showing started over an hour ago. You can still make the 12:15 showing if you hurry up. And I'm like, just what? You know, because the theater is only a 15-minute drive from the house. You know, we left the house at 10:45, and now it's 12:20. So I had lost, you know, a good hour, you know, over an hour to get to the theater. And certainly it didn't take that much to get there. It didn't take that long to get to the theater. And so I just buy the tickets because we're already there, rush in, find a seat. And, you know, the movie had already started. It's pitch black. And my son, my oldest one, the one that really wanted to see this movie, is just wigging out. And I've never seen him like this. He is just crying and wailing and screaming. He just wants to get out of there, you know, and he's scared of the dark, which he never was before. He didn't have any problems with the dark, but we've been to many movies before that with him. But for whatever reason, that day, he did not want to be in that theater in that pitch black. And he kept crying. I couldn't calm him down. So, and I'm freaking out myself because I'm trying to figure out, you know, what exactly just happened on the way to the theater. Where did all this missing time go? And we just leave. I just left. Forget it. Let's go home. I'll try this another time. And I get home, and as soon as we walk in the door, first thing the wife says, how was the movie? Like, we never got to see it. It's like, well, where have you been all this time if you didn't get to see it? So then, you know, I explained everything that happened. But yeah, that was certainly an unusual experience.
And of course, looking back, you have any thoughts on what that, you know, what was different about that one? What could have possibly occurred?
So the first thought most people have, well, obviously you're an abductee. And certainly at the time, I was actually in an abductee support group trying to figure out what was going on with. What was up with this voice or that triangle encounter or the other UFOs I've seen? Am I an abductee and I just don't know it, or is there something else at play? So what I think actually happened is a little odd, because certainly I don't think I was abducted that day myself or the kids. I suspect what happened is at the time I was trying to fit in. You know, I was trying to find out where I fit in all of this. And of course, being in the abduction support group, I figured at that time that's kind of where I belonged. And that for me would have been the easy answer to just, yep, you know, it was aliens, done deal, case closed. But so here's the thing with the voice, it comes across whatever way it needs to elicit a certain response from you, to get a certain chain effect, chain reaction as a result of it. I suspect the voice came across demonic to scare the hell out of me, to keep my eyes off the clock, because somehow I personally was responsible for the missing time. And that I still can't, you know, fully explain, because that certainly sounds crazy. How could I be responsible for suddenly warping, if you will, into the future by over an hour? But it seems more of a realistic answer to me than to say aliens came down, you know, stop time or whatever, had taken us out of the car and abducted us. Somehow, I think consciousness played a large part into manipulating time in a way that I actually lost. And another example might be, I want to say a couple years ago, I read a story about a woman that drowned her kids. Threw her kids in the back of the car, drove it into a lake, and drowned her whole family in the car. And when asked why she did it, she said the devil told her to do it. So a situation like that could be, again, retrocausality using an air signal to produce a future event. So let's say this woman despised her children, didn't want her kids, constantly was dwelling on the fact that she wishes they were dead. You know, but the problem is she didn't actually want to be responsible for killing them herself, you know, to bear that conscious responsibility of being the one that takes their lives. But she was constantly focused on wanting them dead. So the way it might play out in a situation like that is a future event presents itself to where she can possibly kill her kids through a retrocausal event that would convince her to do it. So in this case, it may be she hears a voice, you know, drown your kids in the lake. And she swears it's the devil telling her to do it. And naturally, she blows them up in the car, drives them into the lake, and kills all of them. When this voice was merely an air signal to produce that future event that she essentially willed into reality.
Well, all that being said, do you think there is something else going on with the whole abduction UFO phenomenon that we're not understanding?
Oh, certainly there's a lot going on that we don't understand, and we don't even understand enough to ask the right questions yet. I mean, even, there are certain kinds of false awakenings, type 2 false awakenings. So there are three encounters I had, two with a werewolf and one with the lady in white, or some might call her an angel, where I woke up and had an encounter with these beings. And it seemed ultra realistic, enough that you couldn't separate that reality from this one. You couldn't tell them apart, because they're essentially the same thing. And you wouldn't really know the difference. So when it comes to alien abductions, of course, a lot of times it happens in people's bedrooms at night in bed. They're awoken to find they're surrounded by aliens, taken out of the room, float through the wall, to the craft, whatever. We haven't really explored the whole false awakening explanation. So a false awakening, there's right now two types. Type one is essentially where you wake up and you don't realize you're asleep. So you may wake up, go about your regular morning routine, make coffee, go to the bathroom, hop in the shower, and have no idea that you're still in bed asleep, because you wouldn't know. I mean, there's no way to tell. It's just like any other morning when you wake up. There's nothing telling you that it's anything different. A type two is that same thing where you wake up in your house, in your bed, go about your routine. You might go about when you wake up, except usually right off the bat, something feels off, something feels wrong, something feels evil, and you have some kind of encounter with the being, be it, in my case, werewolves, others, you know, it was shadow beings, wolves in the bed, something that's basically going to scare the hell out of you. And I suspect some of those may be aliens as well. And then type three, I would probably classify as a divine experience where I met this lady in white, where it was just the opposite of a type two, but there is no, you know, classification right now for a type three. And there's really no study done on these types of dreams.
So do you think that we're just basically creating these events in our minds, or do you think that we're actually, you know, being visited by entities?
I think reality is a lot stranger than we imagine. And we don't fully understand just exactly how reality works or how consciousness interacts with that reality. So, you know, Jacques Vallée would say that most of the UFO phenomena is just completely absurd to be true. And that a lot of it seems to be non-physical, or maybe on a spiritual level or some kind of non-physical level. And then you have the aspect that a lot of it seems to change over time and match the technological level that we are at. So, you know, in the 1890s, it was airships, you know, with anchors and balloons kind of deal. And then over time, it's changed as we've changed. You know, way back in the heyday, you know, we talked the Bible, chariots of fire. So it seems to be closely tied, I think, to consciousness and how that consciousness interacts with reality and maybe even controls it. I mean, right now, like with Jacques Vallée, his thing is, you know, the future of physics, of science, is information, where right now we're stuck in this whole materialistic viewpoint of reality and science, you know, as energy and material and matter, and information side of it, we really haven't got into yet. So I think we're going to find that consciousness exists outside of the brain and isn't just a product of the brain.
Now, I've had incidences of sleep paralysis where I actually saw shadow beings while I was trying to wake up. Do you think that's linked to the false awakening phenomenon?
Yeah, I've also had sleep paralysis as well. And during these episodes with the false awakening, I was paralyzed on both occasions with the werewolf. So I suspect there's a connection between sleep paralysis and a false awakening state.
Now, where did you come to the conclusions that you did about, you know, about retrocausality and false awakenings? Was it just from, you know, your own research? Is there anything particular that you were researching to help you come to these conclusions?
With retrocausality, I had read a white paper from a scientist some years ago who was writing about precognition and feedback. And he suspected there was some kind of feedback channel that may have... So basically, you know, if you're alive 10 minutes from now, an hour from now, if you're alive tomorrow, you're going to be creating new memories, whatever those memories are. So what if there's a way to access your future memories? And that's kind of what he suspected was going on, is that precognition was really just someone's accessing future memories before they've actually had the experience which produces those memories. So I went down that pathway because feedback made sense to me in the whole control system. And if we look at everything around us, you know, take your body, for example, you know, it's full of control systems and feedback loops that keep it functioning. Without these control systems or those feedback loops, we couldn't function. You know, a simple thing is just moderating your body temperature. You know, you get hot, what does you do? Your body sweats until it cools off enough that it tells your body to stop sweating because you reached the desired temperature that it should be at. So it would seem, you know, a no-brainer that space-time and our interaction with it, the way consciousness interacts with it, is also under a control system. That as far as so in the example with the AC, you know, if your house is at 72 degrees and you have the thermostat set at 72 degrees, it doesn't need to do anything. The house temperature is already at the desired temperature, so there's no action required. That would be causality, cause and effect. It just automatically works. There's no action needed. But when a retrocausal event influences the past, that's where the control system steps in, because there needs to be a control system that's going to monitor and control the way that that event influences the past and thereby creates that future event. So it's essentially influencing the path and then creating a causal pathway to that future event. So it's just a control system that's using an air signal. And that's the purpose of our gut instinct intuition, is to basically provide a pathway for that information. So when you get into the models of reality, they talk about, physicists, when we talk about time travel, you know, you have time travel where you're speeding beyond, going, you know, near the speed of light, you're traveling into the future. But physicists also talk about CTCs, which is closed time-like curves, essentially time-like loops that extend from every point in space-time. So I suspect the purpose of these loops is to actually provide an information pathway between two points in space-time. And that's what we see happening here in these examples with retrocausality, is that CTCs are providing a pathway for the air signal to travel from A to B to influence the past, and thereby create a new causal pathway to that future event.
Wow, that is fascinating stuff. And it adds, so many different levels to the whole paranormal UFO psychic phenomenon that, you know, I had never taken into consideration before. But, it, you know, a lot of it makes so much sense, and the research you've done on it, I think it sheds a lot of light on this phenomenon.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I haven't even got into a lot of it, but you know, just touching on what I have so far, certainly for me, at least, answers a lot of questions that I have been searching for, you know, my whole life, trying to come down to and understand. And all this was really just not to understand the phenomena as a whole, but to understand what was going on with myself, what was happening to me, and trying to get to the bottom of this voice and determining why it's happening to me and what it means. So, you know, all my work and my research and everything I've been doing is stemmed from basically that work, trying to understand myself.
Since that last occurrence, have you had any other voices, heard any other voices, or had any other experiences like that?
Well, with the accidents with my daughter, you know, that scared the hell out of me, because I realized that somehow, some way, I was responsible for her accidents. And at that time, I couldn't fully explain it, but I knew that I was creating these incidents, even though I didn't know how. So from that point on, I began changing the way I think and changing the way I do things, not being so focused, for one, on the future, but any specific event. And it seemed to have worked. That was the last time I've heard that voice. And it's almost been 20 years now since this happened. So whatever I did seems to have stopped it. I have no doubt that if I really wanted to do it again, I can certainly go down that road. But it's dangerous when you have this thing you can do and you don't necessarily have any control of it, because you don't know what's going to come out of it. And certainly with my daughter, I didn't want to cause any serious harm to her that I couldn't take back. Or anyone else for that matter, like the softball example. So, I'm grateful that it stopped, and it's been 20 years since this happened almost. And I'm not sure I would want to go down that path again.
Right. Well, Sean, thank you so much for coming on tonight. That was fascinating information. And you have a, you'll be in an upcoming series on the trail of UFOs, right? When should we look for that?
It should be released in the spring of 2020. Small Town Monsters is putting out a new series on the trail of UFOs, and I'll be doing an interview in one of those episodes. And, of course, people can always find me on – I don't have my own website, but you can find me on Facebook. It's just facebook.com/SeanKevinJason.
Very good. Well, Sean, thank you so much for coming on tonight. That was absolutely fascinating stuff, and we'll have you back on in the future.
Look forward to it, Chris.